let's recall a little bit what we saw last time. We discussed that under the assumption that I colloquial relation, that is, we'll discuss a little bit because there was a discussion at the end of the lecture with you that I want to retake about the dependence on A and B. It was with you, right?
Yeah.
Because based on your face, I was like, ooh, maybe I'm confusing the person. Yeah? that I want to retake, but for now, at least without interpretation of any kind, under the assumption that this is true, remember, with this lambda being a set of hidden variables that we don't have access to, possibly random variables distributed with some probability distribution, we found that the correlators of the measures, when you have two possible outcomes, plus minus one, has to be less or equal than two. Agreed? Under the assumption that I call local realism, that we can discuss a little bit after. Before discussing a little bit the implications, we did an example, or started to do an example, but again, very fast, so let's do it now. In quantum mechanics, where we pick, this is a prediction for quantum mechanics. So if quantum mechanics is a good proxy for what experiment results would be, this is predicting an experiment. So we have two set of observables, on A, two settings of measurement, basically measure the spin, think of a spin of an electron if you want, measure the spin in the Z axis, measure the spin in the X axis, right? Two setups. I have a Stenger-Lach like that, a Stenger-Lach like that, if you want. And for B, very similar, but rotated 45 degrees, the axis. We have two setups, then you measure in the direction Z plus X, or you measure the spin in the Z minus X direction, all right? And the one thing that we didn't do because we didn't have time, or in fact, I tried to do very fast, but we didn't have time, it's computing what are the correlators in this case. Okay, so follow with me the calculation. It's actually very simple. So with the set AB, clearly that's the observable we have to compute, right? The expectation of. And it's very easy. I don't have to write the four terms in the product because I know that there's a sigma set A. So only things diagonal on A will survive. So I'll just write the diagonal things on A, which are these two terms. Agreed? And this term gives me, okay, what do I get here? Well, I get a sigma set acting on zero, which is minus one, using the usual convention, so nobody is alienated by that. The usual convention quantum info, this is minus one, this is minus one, but this is also minus one in Z. Oh, so then it's even plus, right? So what do you get? Perfect. It's minus one because of the zero, and then one because of the one in B. So this is a global minus one. Same thing here, minus one for the zero, plus one for the one, well, the opposite, one for the one because it's A, and minus one for the zero in B. So a global minus one. So minus one plus minus one cancels these two and cancels the minus, and you get one over root two. Everybody agrees? We can do all the others. This one is very easy. The only thing that changes is the sign of the X part, and the sign of the X part is crossed out here because these terms are diagonal. So the X part doesn't matter. So if I have a minus in here, it will give me exactly the same result with the same calculation. Agreed? All right. So the only difference is, did I have a minus written here? No, that's the worst, a plus. That's my bad. All right. Minus XB, exactly. That has to be the same one if I did it right. What else? This is exactly the same setting, so we're fine. It's just a sign, it's a change of sign here. So this has to be a plus as well, same thing. Do we agree? All right. Then we have the A prime B. The A prime B is, with the setting A prime is an X here, and with B is the plus in here. So with the A prime B, we only get the non-diagonal terms in here. So I can cancel the sigma set contributions and only write the non-diagonal terms. And you see that we have, the sigma x flips a bit, right? So that gives me, in this one, a one for the A. There's a minus here that I carry. Same thing here. So I get, the minus that I carry here, and the minus that I carry here is minus one, so I get minus one over root two. Everybody agrees with the arithmetics? It's important, okay, because I did this right 5 minutes before coming, making sure I didn't make any mistakes. But before coming, I mean like when I was here waiting for you. And then we have the prime prime setting, which I haven't done, but the prime prime setting is just having a plus in here. So clearly that would give me 1 root 2, right? Now, probably I made a mistake there. Yes, go ahead.
Is the just the B unprimed? Shouldn't there be a plus in that rather than a minus?
The B unprimed, sorry, where?
Like in the third correlator.
The third one?
It's B unprimed, but there's this subtraction between the sigmas.
Thank you. The B unprimed is with the plus, yep. Thank you. Agreed. All right, so now let's see. Because the one that should have been negative is this one. So maybe I got the setups wrong. So I need the negative to AB prime to be the negative. So it's likely then that I got this one wrong. Because I need the AB prime to be negative for that inequality, right?
But the first one doesn't change as well.
The first one would change as well?
Yeah, because you change the sign of B.
Maybe we should do it more carefully.
That's what we had in the last lecture.
Wait, what?
Oh, in the last lecture, what do we have?
We had.
No, okay.
Flipped in the last lecture.
Ah, there's a slight problem with that one.
Yeah, last lecture, the B prime was positive, B was negative.
B prime was positive, B was negative. B prime was positive, B was negative. B prime, okay, let's try to do this. So it's a matter of the choice of state. I feel really bad because I checked this one before coming, so I feel.
Maybe the second one, you didn't if you calculate it as minus.
What's that?
Maybe with the same setup, if you calculate the second one, it's minus 1 over square root of 2, but you just didn't calculate.
That could be. So the point here is that you have a minus with this, but the problem with that is that this one gives nothing. If the setup is B prime and A is sigma set, so only the diagonal survive. Uh-huh. So this one will not change with respect to that one. Okay? You see, like, here, the sigma x does nothing, right. Nothing at all. Agreed? So this is just an arithmetic, so I'm going to ask you to excuse me for now with that, because it's a choice of the Bell state that we pick, and a choice of the, because I pick, that's what I'm missing, right? The cross sign. There you go, because I did it like here. Very good. So in the ones that are non-diagonal, one term, it has a sign with respect to the other. And this one is diagonal. But that one is diagonal, so this one is diagonal. It shouldn't have a minus in this one.
Wasn't psi minus that plus the other one?
No, psi minus is minus for sure in the definition. That's why you have a minus, right?
Yeah, I thought so. But last session, when you wrote psi minus, you had a plus for some reason.
Yeah.
I had a plus there?
Yes.
Okay, well, that was probably a typo. So anyways, let's leave it there. And at the end of the lecture, I'll stay here doing the... Oh, you have another lecture after?
Yeah.
Okay, well then at the end of the lecture, I will do it. And I will...
Here, the next
okay, I will do it properly and I will show you properly. But I hope that it's clear that you can pick the conspiracy, if you want, between the observables and the state to get the right sign there that I want. Because basically, the freedom that I have, it's clear that picking plus minus here and picking phi versus psi, I have freedoms to change the sign of all of these guys. And picking the observables as well. The only point that I need is that this is a norm one set of observables, so you need the thing to be normalized if there's a sum, all right? To be comparable, to be commensurate. But again, it's a matter of arithmetics, and I hope you see that. And I promise to you that I will do it properly. At least for the notes that are being compiled, we will have the right one, okay? Sorry about that. Because for this one definitely looks that I haven't made any mistakes and those are the results. And if we swapped, just to take a look, if we were to swap B and B prime, wouldn't we get, because B and B prime doesn't change the diagonal ones? No, that wouldn't change the diagonal ones. So if I want to check the diagonal ones, no, because B has a minus, and B prime doesn't have a minus. That is it, right? No, because it's exactly the same, but it's a that's exactly right. Sorry about that. Look at that. That's it. I found it. B has a minus, and B prime doesn't have a minus, so it's not exactly the same. Make sense? The minus that that B has is here, and I copied exactly the same thing. This one doesn't have a minus, so it's minus one, but there's no minus to cancel. So it's one. It's for doing it fast, because I didn't operate that. Make sense, everybody?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And now, same thing here. It's the sign that's missing. Now we're fine. Thank you. Thank you. Well, you didn't find it, but you helped me. You inspired me to find it. All right, very good. Now we're fine. Now that we know that, we can write, of course, the following sum here. Let me write it here, right? Let me make a little box, it's not to take another board. And we get that the absolute value of A of A, B of B, expectation, of course, B of B, minus A, B of B, okay, prime, plus A prime, expectation, B of B prime. All right. Plus expectation of A prime, B, B prime, and of the absolute value, it's equal to, so this is 1 over root 2. This is 1 over root 2, minus 1 over root 2. This one is not here, sorry. 1 over root 2, and this one is 1 over root 2. Agreed? So the result is 2 root 2, which clearly is larger than 2. Make sense? So quantum mechanics, even for a very simple choice of an entangled state and for a very simple choice of observables, we find a very simple experiment that violates local realism, or the assumptions I made in local realism. Make sense, everybody? So there's a very simple example, very basic example of violation of inequalities, incompatibility between quantum mechanics and local realism. Now let's discuss again local realism for a second. In local realism, there are two assumptions, right? The assumption of locality, which the assumption of locality means that the experiment on B cannot depend on the settings of A. The results of an experiment on B, the measurements that you make on B, cannot depend on the settings of A, and vice versa, right? Both in both cases. And the realism one that says, well, yeah, there's a series of variables that represent physical reality, elements of physical reality that you don't have access to and influence your experiment. Make sense? Now, when I was discussing realism as a very reasonable assumption, there was a discussion at the end of the lecture that many of you left, but just to have it, whether the fact that A and B could have a common cause of some kind would already violate this notion of locality. And the answer is no, because look, let me give you an example of something that could happen. Imagine that they do have a common cause or whatever, but then at some point in my lab, I decide to change my settings. If I change my settings in my lab, regardless of the past, I'm assuming that I'm not affecting the settings at lab B. Lab B could be space-like separated, so if relativity is believable, then certainly a change that I do here will not affect B. So basically, it's an experimental fact. You can say, I changed my settings to 1/2 instead of 1. Did your experiment change? And they said, no. So you have to make sure of the no-influence loophole, if you want. One way to do it is being space-like separated, because we believe at the levels of energy that we live, relativity applies. So my decisions in A, this is a decision of the setups, a physical change in turning of the dials would not affect the results of B. That is the assumption, which is a very reasonable physical assumption. Theories that violate that, better do it in high energy. You will not see a serious physical theory that is non-local and is not talking about high energy. Make sense? And I say talking about high energy because we have a ton of evidence that relativity works really well. And again, we assume that maybe relativity fails at some point, but they're certainly not at the level of doing Stenger-Lach experiments. Make sense, everybody? Does that make sense, the notion of locality? You could even decide your setups randomly, as in, well, you may believe there's no such thing as random sources, but you can use an atom preparing a superposition of two levels of energy and measure there, then maybe you don't believe quantum mechanics, that's fine. But it's very difficult. You can use the free will loop if you want as well. You can use, well, but I can get a random person on the street and ask, what setting do I do? Maybe that's not random either. But you see, it makes it really tough. The conspiracy that you need in order for locality not to be real is huge. Make sense, everybody? In fact, all these things that I mentioned, people have done. People had a little video game where where people played in the video game decided what setups they use in the lab to do experiments like that. They did it as a joke, but that experiment was funded by many millions of dollars, so it's kind of interesting. Anyway, are we fine then with everything I wrote and said? Perfect. You see how pesky science are? You see, that's the problem with theoretical physics. Many of us are not good at arithmetic. And that sucks because you really want the 2√2 here for the example you picked. Although again, I agree, like theoretical physicists look at this and say, oh yeah, of course I can choose it so that is 2√2, so I don't care, it doesn't do it. And at the time of doing it, signs go away. All right, so the important thing here before we move to the next thing is to realize that local realism, which seemed a very reasonable set of assumptions for all the theories that we had before quantum mechanics, it's not compatible with quantum mechanics, all right? So if the experiments actually reveal that you can get that, because there are two options, right? Either quantum mechanics is wrong, or local realism is not an hypothesis that you can have in physical reality. Make sense? Well, this experiment has been done a lot. First time in 1984, Nobel Prize in physics. Alan Aspect, the guy who did it. Nobel Prize because of that, among other things. But he did the first experiment with light. Nonlinear crystals generated pairs of entangled photons. Or if you want localized pulses of light, because the word photon is a bit loaded, as we will discuss a bit perhaps. And five years ago, the last loophole, which was, you know, with photons, you have the problem of efficiency of detecting light. Sometimes you miss it. Sometimes you click and nothing happened. It's much better if you can do it with a true Stenger-Lach, with something with a mass that can move, you know, and that you know that has passed with almost certainty that, oh yeah, an electron went through. It was actually done with charges in Delft in the Netherlands 5 years ago that closed that loophole, final. And I think that the number of people that believe that there's still room for that not to be true is tiny. So it looks like quantum mechanics is right on this, at the very least. And that means that quantum mechanics cannot be, that reality is not local realistic. Now, of course, the experiment doesn't say which one is wrong. It could be locality or it could be realism. But because we have a ton of evidence that locality is a thing, and better be, because our theories would be crazy if they were not local at this level. Typically, we say that, no, what is failing is realism. So there's no such thing as hidden variables like that. Like these ones, like the ones that I propose. Make sense? Is there room for locality to be not true? Sure. But then again, you have to take into account the whole body of experiments about locality that have been done. Remember that we have checked that Lorentz invariance is respected to scales that are really high. And we have a ton of experimental evidence. So we ought to believe that locality is a thing. If anything, because of relativity. Even before relativity, it's a wild thing. Imagine that we have Galilean, that was okay, the world was Galilean for some reason. The fact that in my lab, I could, with my settings here, affect what happens very far away, it's wild. Something propagated instantaneously. Some spooky action, as we would call it, right? But again, we have relativity. So we decide that realism, or at least the consensus, is that it's realism what fails. Make sense, everybody? So there's no such thing as local hidden variables. Questions before we move. And this is what? And this is, you see how for these kind of experiments to violate the inequalities, and I can tell you that, you require entanglement. Entanglement is a requisite for violations of the inequalities. Make sense? All right. I hope that this makes it very clear, right, that entanglement still within the notions of locality, but not realism. Oftentimes people would say, oh, that state is non-local, but you see, people mean other thing when they mean the word locality is used, I repeat again, in two different contexts here. One to talk about non-separability of the state, okay? But the one that I'm talking about from the foundations of physics is, by locality, I mean it's localizing space-time, cannot affect things that are far away from the causal envelope of the events where the experiment happens. Make sense? All right. So the problem that we face now is, okay, entanglement is interesting because it violates one of the tenets of that were held very sacred in all the theories before quantum mechanics, which is local realism. What's entanglement? We need to understand it. And one of the things, in fact, we're going to end the block on entanglement by seeing a protocol of quantum information, there's quantum teleportation, that can do cool stuff because of entanglement, things that you couldn't do classically. But you see, how do we quantify entanglement? What is entanglement? How, if you give me a state, can I tell if it's entangled? How? And remember that distinguishing whether a state is entangled or not is an NP-hard problem, a problem that is very difficult to solve. Make sense? Even difficult to check the solution of. So we need to go to see what people have came up with in order to quantify entanglement. So this block is going to be on entanglement measures, but first we're going to see something that I love. You know, there's kinds of ideas in mathematical physics that are very simple and really powerful. We're going to see something called Perez criterion. Asher Perez, really cool person, one of the first to publish in relativistic quantum information with Danny Turner. Asher Perez was a Sephardim, one of the members of the Jewish community that were expelled from Spain in the 15th century. Perez is actually a Spanish last name, Spanish origin last name. And these people speak Spanish still the way it was spoken in the 15th century, which is amazing to hear. It looks like you're talking to Cervantes or Lope de Vega or things like that when you talk with a Sephardim in Spanish. The language is called Ladino, and they speak it so well. It's amazing that it survived until today. Big mistake of the time to do what they did. But so it is. Anyway, Asher Perez had a criterion that says, okay, let's take a look at what I call the partial, let me define the partial transpose. It's really clever. Partial transpose. So if I have rho AB, let me say a bipartite system, rho AB, that is the sum over I, J, K, and L of rho I, K, J, and L, A, J, B, K, A, L, B. Okay? I define the partial transpose with respect to okay, notations for partial transpose. There are many notations. Sometimes people write a half T, which looks like a gamma. I don't. I write a T sub A. Both are notations that are common, but just if you see a half T at some point in a density matrix, it also means partial transpose. Make sense? It's kind of to be cute about it, I guess, because it's partial, so half. I don't know. But people do use that. All right, partial transpose with respect to B. What is that? Well, it's the transpose, but just for one of the subsystems. So the definition is going to be the sum I, J, K, L of rho I, J, K, L. Then I, L, A, B. I'm doing the respect to A first. Oh, I swapped it, sorry. L, I don't touch A. But I do touch B. And similarly, rho I, J, K, L. And this is going to swap these two. So K, A, oh, my bad. J, B, I, A, and K L B. Make sense? So very simply.
Did you exchange the indices JK? What was your convention? Is the first two indices of row for system A?
I really don't care, right? But yes, it doesn't really matter. Yes, this is first and second, but I'm not going to touch the coefficients. I'm going to touch the bases, so it doesn't matter. I could swap the coefficients for sure.
I think you touched it there.
Then I touched the bases, not the coefficients, right?
The coefficients
change. Sorry. I didn't touch the bases. My bad. I, J, K, L. Make sense? Either you change one or the other. Not both. Make sense, everybody? So easy example, right? If you had an element, let's say that is B, and something like 0a, 0b. If you do the partial transpose with respect to b, that's going to be 0a, 0b, 0a, 1b. Make sense, everybody? So it is a transpose. Maybe I could have done this to make it explicit that I'm not doing anything on A. That actually illustrates it better. Make sense, everybody? I don't touch A, I transpose with respect to B. Okay, so the partial transpose is a pretty unphysical operation. Agreed? It means really nothing, physically speaking. In fact, you know, if you partial transpose a density matrix, you're not guaranteed to get a density matrix back. Make sense? Partial transpose can mess an operator being positive. However, Perez realized of the following. Well, let's write if.
Why?
Question?
Why do partial transpose messed with positive being for row being positive definite or positive?
Yeah, because the transpose of a density matrix is positive definite, but the partial transpose only messes with half of the matrix. So you can have cross terms between the two systems. Let me maybe define Perez criterion, because that's the key, actually. So maybe I'll define Perez criterion, and we'll understand it better, I think. If row AB is separable, which means not entangled, right, then I know that row AB. So actually, what I'm going to write is if rho AB, it's going to be sum over I, as we saw, of, let's call it CI, for example, rho AI tensor rho BI. Right? That's the definition of not being entangled, being separable. Agreed? But if that's the case, and this is only an arrow to the right, now it's no longer double. If that's the case, if I take the partial transpose, say with respect to B, of that density matrix AB, then I know that this is going to be this convex combination I, because it's a tensor, I can just do the partial transpose of the B part. Agreed? And what does that mean? Well, the partial transpose of a density matrix is a density matrix. Sorry, the partial transpose. The transpose of a density matrix is a density matrix. Agreed? And that means that this thing, then rho AB, is a positive semi-definite operator. Because it's still a density matrix. See what I mean? But you see the condition, and that connects with your question. In order for this to still be a density matrix, there couldn't be cross terms between A and B that will be messed up one way. You need to be able to factor it like that in order for it to be a positive operator. And that is what Perez realized. Perez said, aha, if I take the partial transpose and I get a positive semi-definite matrix operator, then that means that the state was separable. I find a sufficient condition. It's not necessary. Things could conspire. Still, it's not guaranteed that doing the partial transpose you will mess up the positivity always. No, things could conspire to give you a positive operator. But at least you know that if it starts being separable, you are guaranteed to always have a positive operator when you do a partial transpose. So Perez criterion tells you, can you see if I write here, everybody?
I can barely see. Like if you're like in the top half, I could see, but then the bottom.
Okay, I'll do just the top half then.
Okay, yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah. So Perez criterion tells you that if rho AB partial transpose with respect to A or B doesn't matter, because obviously this would be the same if I partial transpose with respect to the other. Has at least one negative eigenvalue, then rho AB is entangled. Makes sense, because I cannot write it like that. You wouldn't have a negative eigenvalue if you are able to write it like that, because you are guaranteed to have a positive operator at the end. Makes sense? That's the criteria. This is a criterion that is extremely handy, because it tells you right away, if I compute the eigenvalues of the partial transpose density matrix and one of them is negative, I know that's an entangled state. Yeah, go ahead.
Would you have to like check both? Like,
no.
Partial, oh.
If one is, the other one isn't either. Yeah, entanglement has a notion of symmetry in a way, right?
Okay.
It's not separable with respect to either. Only one. So this is really nice, because now for at least some states, for at least some entangled states, you identify that if the partial transpose, which is an operation that is linear with the size of the matrix, because it's a self-adjoint, not linear, but polynomial, if you want. Diagonalization, which is also polynomial with the size of the matrix. In fact, diagonalization is polynomial, but finding the eigenvalues is a little bit better, too, only the eigenvalues. I'm able to tell that the state was entangled, sometimes. Most of the times, actually, but many times.
Does it go the other way?
No, but we're going to discuss in what cases it does. So because this arrow is only this way, again, things could conspire so that it wasn't like that, but you end up with a positive matrix. But those things are rarer. Let's talk about it. Are we going to talk about how rare? But is that understood? That at least we have a criteria of sufficiency for being entangled. A sufficient condition for being entangled is that the partial transpose has negative eigenvalues. Make sense? That's so when the problem of distinguishing entanglement is NP-hard, having a sufficiency condition is great. It's a bit more powerful than that, because we know three things. We know that if the Hilbert space AB is dimension, let me write 2 by 2, right? I'm going to write it in terms of the dimensions of each subsystem, Hilbert space, or 3 by 2. Then rho transpose A or B not being positive semi-definite means that rho AB is non-separable. So in 2 by 2 or 3 by 2, for 2 qubits or for a qubit and a qubit, is necessary and sufficient. There is no room there for the operator to be positive if it's not separable. So for qubits, it's fine. This thing is necessary and sufficient. For qubits and qubits, it's also fine. There are also other cases that I'm not going to write here. Like, for example, for Gaussian states that are single mode, at least one of the subsystems is single mode, even if it's infinite dimension, things like that work as well. But I'm not going to get there because introduction to quantum info is not going to do much in continuous variables quantum info. So, but yeah, good. Is that clear for everybody? So the criterion is actually pretty good for qubits. Pretty good as in like completely good as it gets. And for qubits and qubits. And when? So then maybe one can say something about the cases in higher dimensions. So you see, there are some now you can divide entangled states in two categories, right? The ones that give you a physical state when you partial transpose and the ones that don't. Is something special about one of the categories? And the answer is yes. Yes, there is something special. Let me define something for you. I'm going to define distillable entanglement. Oh, I'm going to give you the informal definition. When we get to entanglement measures, we're going to see some formal definitions of entanglement measures, right? But let's, for now, get the intuitive definition of distillable entanglement. And the intuitive definition is actually more accurate than the formal one that you will see in books and on the, online if you look it up, and I'll tell you why. Distillable entanglement. The number of maximally entangled states of lower dimension, typically qubits. Typically Bell pairs, let's call it that. Bell pairs, and we'll discuss that. That one can obtain from n copies of an entangled state rho AB, or an state rho AB, and LOCC. So the idea here is I give you a state of dimension 10 by 10, for example, and it's entangled. And then you say, OK, now I'm going to start coupling, think of the qubit case. I'm going to start coupling qubits to it with unitaries to the system, right, to the two subsystems. And I'm going to do the best possible strategy, that is LOCC, and we will discuss what that means. LOCC means local operation and classical communication, as you saw in the tutorial, right? So you can work with a friend, and you're allowed to do things to the system, do unitaries, coordinate the unitaries. That's the CC part. It's not like unitaries that I can decide, but I can also coordinate the best strategy with my friend, which opens the doors to a wildly higher number of operations that you can do. You could even measure the sum of the systems. Some of the systems I'm going to measure first. I'm going to discard it. I'm going to measure. And then I know what to do better. You see how computing is tough? It's an optimization over everything that you can do LOCC. Not necessarily unitary operations at all. It's local operations, which may not be unitary, like measurements, and classical communication. You can measure. You can coordinate. You start to get probably how computing these things is tough, because it's going to require optimizations over huge spaces, all right? But the reason that I say typically Bell pairs is because informally it's typically say the number of Bell pairs that you can extract from n copies of the system and LOCC, the distillable entanglement of the ensemble of the n systems, rho AB, n copies that you have the rho AB. Now, the reason I say typically Bell pairs is because there are works relatively recent that say, actually, there are some states that if you don't want Bell states, but you want maximally entangled states of dimension 3, you can get more. Entanglement is tough. You see what I mean? So typically people think, this is intuitive. Bits, right, that's the smallest thing that I can. So of course, the number of Bell pairs will tell me, well, you can have states that you can extract very few Bell pairs, but you can extract a lot of genuinely tripartite entanglement or bipartite entanglement of higher dimension that you can in terms of Bell pairs. So there are, it's tough to define these things, okay? But if you think in terms of Bell pairs, then I'll give you this statement. If rho AB has rho AB transpose with respect to A or B has negative eigenvalues, then rho AB has distillable entanglement. In fact, all right. So what it tells you is for any dimensions, if you satisfy Peres' criterion for being entangled, you can prove that you have distillable entanglement. So the question is there entanglement that's not distillable? Indeed. We call it bound entanglement. Entanglement that is, cannot be transformed into maximally entangled states by means of LOCC. So Peres' criterion is helpful because it identifies distillable entanglement. What this tells you is that all the entanglement in 2x3 and 2x2 is distillable, can be transformed into Bell pairs. Make sense, hopefully? Yep.
Can I just make sure I understand the experimental setup? So we have, we start with some entangled state by rho, and then we partition into A and B. My friend has A, we're on the phone, and we're creating entangled pairs just by themselves from this entangled
state. That's right. Like coupling things to it, for example, yeah. And doing whatever you want, any kind of channel between them. Make sense? Yeah.
Why n copies?
Oh, well, because from one of them, of course, I mean, you can talk about one, and then you can think of zero. You can have a definition divided by n, and then you call it distillable entanglement as an entanglement measure, and then it may be 0.5 or 0.1. But technically, the distillable entanglement of an ensemble, I give you n copies, and then you're allowed, you know, it depends on n, and it's larger the larger n, obviously. And is the number of Bell pairs I can extract when you give n. Now, you can also normalize this to divide by n, and then you get that it's 0.1 Bell pairs per state. And then that maybe is a measure of entanglement, maybe it's not, as we will discuss. Make sense? This is just to give you a little bit of insight on distillable entanglement, on Peres' criterion. There's something special about those states whose partial transpose have negative eigenvalues, even in dimensions higher than 2x2 and 3x2. Typically, those are the ones that you would like as a resource, because you really want Bell pairs to do stuff in quantum computing. Make sense, everybody? Any questions? Please, always.
For classical correlations also, there are some things that like when we write the holistic system, it's not separable, right?
No. Separable? Ah, okay, what you mean is, can you be entangled and also have classical correlations? The answer is yes.
I mean, how this theorem distinguishes between classical correlations and entanglement?
No, this distinguishes because this thing has classical correlations. Mm-hmm. That's very important. So this means that it's not entangled. By definition of entanglement, remember the definition of an entangled state is a state that is not like that. This state can have, and in fact, if the number of Sumans is more than one, it has classical correlations, like the two balls that I wrote, right? So states with classical correlations but no entanglement are separable. And you would get zero negative eigenvalues in the partial transpose in that case. A state with classical correlations is like this, and only classical correlations. What's that?
In every basis that you choose?
No, you can write it like that. Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. You can write it like that. Make sense?
Where in Ruby are pure?
No. Not necessarily. There's no one decomposition. You can find one where they're pure, for sure. No, not even, because it could be mixed. No, not really. This is even not unique, but you can write it like that. Make sense? Yeah.
I'm a bit confused about this concept of distillable entanglement. It seems like, is it some sort of process of removing entanglement in a way?
It's the opposite, right? Distilling it. In mind that you can use, for your quantum computer, you can only use Bell pairs.
So you're starting from Bell pairs?
And No. You don't start from Bell pairs. Imagine that you need Bell pairs. You want Bell pairs. You don't have them, but you want them.
And you're starting from something not entangled?
No, you start from something that has a little bit of entanglement.
And then you're just extracting
Bell pairs from it.
Out of it.
That's right. If there's entanglement, maybe you're able to get Bell pairs out of it. If you are able, it's because you have distillable entanglement.
I think part of my confusion is that I thought LOCC couldn't create more entanglement.
So and it doesn't.
It's just removing.
That is extremely important. It's not creating, it's distilling it. The entanglement is there, not in the form of Bell pairs, but it is there. Imagine that I give you a state of dimension 200, and there's a little bit of entanglement there, but spread over the whole dimension. Maybe you can get four Bell pairs from it. See what I mean? Because that's dimension two, or four. Okay. Make sense? So that's why it's called distillable. You distill it. It is there, but not in the form of Bell pairs. You want to make it the form of Bell pairs.
Wait, so is it possible that you wouldn't be able to?
Yes, it is possible. That's called bound entanglement.
Oh.
There is entanglement that cannot be transformed into Bell pairs by LOCC. And that entanglement could be argued, could be less useful for quantum computing, because you may need bell pairs for quantum computing. So there's a special kind of entanglement called bound entanglement that cannot be distilled. Yeah, yeah.
Would that not give you, that sort of entanglement not give you negative eigenvalues in the
transpose? Exactly. That's what that's what this is telling you.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not proving it. Proving these things are involved. They're proven. You can find the proofs. They're in papers and they're long. They're beefy proofs. The partial trace is not related to LOCC, but it's a local operation in the sense that it's only over one subsystem. Okay? It's not physical. LOCC talks about things that could be thought of that you could do. Local operations that I can hear, but I can coordinate them in a way. Quantum channels. Partial transpose is not a quantum channel because it doesn't map positive operators trace one to positive operators trace one in general. When it does, it's only when the state is separable in 2 by 2 and 3 by 2. Okay? But it may not do it. So it's not within the LOCC category.
Yeah, but like bound entangled space.
Exactly. That is not within, precisely, it's not within the LOCC. Yeah. Bound entanglement, oh no, hold on. What would you want to say?
Yeah, but like the existence of bound entangled state,
something like,
say, there's a relation
to the LOCC. Not necessarily, no, because again, for a subclass of states, yes, but not for all states. Partial transpose is not LOCC. It's not a quantum channel. To be a quantum channel, you need to be able to map every positive operator trace one to every positive operator trace one. Make sense? Partial transpose doesn't do it, always.
Can you give us some
sketches? No. I can give you references if you want. Of what, of proof of what? Of this? No. Bound entanglement is extremely tough. Yeah. Yeah.
In this process,
I cannot even give you an example of a bound entangled state. Off the top of my mind. It's not simple to write, yeah.
Is it probable that if we take infinite copies, we can extract all of the entanglement in bell pairs?
Sorry, what's the question? If you have infinitely many and you have some distillable entanglement, you can get infinitely many bell pairs.
But can we show that it's we absorb all of the entanglement into the bell pairs? Like,
I'm not sure. A state could have some entanglement that you cannot distill. That's what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could.
Sometime it will saturate. This is my question.
It's technically possible. Mm-hmm. It's technically possible. Let's see. Yes, it's technically possible that you can saturate. Yes. Yeah. You can make a construction where you could saturate, for sure. That there's no way that you can get any more, even if you get more copies. Yeah, that could be. Those are involved, huh? And probably requires infinitely many. Yeah. In infinite dimensions, I can give you examples. But only in finite dimensions, I'm not sure. So yeah, I'm sorry about that. I don't have the answers about this. Yeah, go ahead.
Then if all me and my friend have are bell pairs, we can't build bound entangled states?
You cannot, yeah. That's the thing. Not with LOCC, yeah. Exactly. That is both ways, too. Bound entanglement is a bit weird, but it exists, and it's important to keep it in mind. Okay, but the notion of bound entanglement is just defined through distillable entanglement. You know what I mean? It's entanglement that cannot be distilled into bell pairs. You cannot transform all the entanglement you have into bell pairs always. That's all that I want to say on that. Make sense? All right, so now we're going to move, it's a bit late, but we're going to move to, at least I'm going to do the table, to what something called entanglement measures, which is how do I quantify, unless you have more questions, I'm happy to discuss. I don't know, you have a face, question face, no?
No, it's just an interesting face.
All right. You see, we have a criterion to distinguish entangled states.
Can I just ask one last?
Please, yep.
Okay. Is this distillable entanglement, are those ones that like correlations are going to violate is equality that we have, but bound entanglement doesn't also,
you're asking me, can you violate something that are like Bell inequalities with bound entanglement? I don't know the answer to that, unfortunately. In principle, yes, because it's still entanglement, but I'm not sure. I cannot tell you. All my definition about entanglement is it cannot be distilled into Bell pairs. That's all.
And the only thing that we're sure about these inequalities is that bell pairs can violate this.
Well, not only bell pairs, right? Because bell pairs violating maximally, I can get another set that is not a bell pair that will give me more than two still. And this is for qubits anyways. And for qubits, all entanglement is distillable. Okay? Make sense, everybody? Sorry, I don't have more answer about that. That was supposed to be a comment, not the core of the topic. I understand that it's interesting. But it's a tough topic, if you want. Make sense? It's typically not mentioned, and people live happy lives. But I can't just not mention it. The same way that I'm going to mention a kind of quantum correlations that are not entangled, but also not classical correlations, that are called quantum discord, and we will talk about that a little bit as well, which is also tough. Yeah, question.
So just wondering, like, if you have like a quantum field theory, and then there.
Oh, quantum field theory. Setting is changed. What's up?
But like, there are some entanglement in the field theory.
Yeah.
There are usually distillable entanglement or not.
There are just distillable entanglement in the vacuum state of a quantum field theory in flat space time. Answer is yes. Yeah.
And then is it possible there are also?
In fact, it's infinitely much. If you want, yeah. Is it possible to distill it into bell pairs? The answer is yes. Can you extract entanglement from the vacuum state of a field theory? The answer is yes. And can you make bell pairs with it? Yeah, with enough resources, yeah, you can.
But isn't it infinite dimensional?
Like, yeah, it is infinite dimensional.
How do you define
well, I couple qubits to it, and I'm allowed to do coupling. I can have a qubit coupling to the field here, a qubit coupling to the field here, and we can coordinate how we couple them so that the qubits end up entangled. If the qubits have any kind of entanglement, that's 2x2 entanglement, that's distillable. Do it a gazillion of times, and there you go. You get your bell pairs out of the vacuum entanglement. There are protocols that do that in relativistic quantum information, by the way. They're called entanglement harvesting, if you're interested about that. But yeah, you can do it. You are so, I don't know what. Okay, we can talk about it after the lecture, because that goes on a tangent, but the answer is yes. You can extract bell pairs from the vacuum of a quantum field in flat space-time, free quantum field, yes. Okay, more questions? All right. So the next thing we're going to see, and I'm going to just give you the table, is a relatively decent set of entanglement measures. That is, how do we measure the amount, how do we quantify things that measure entanglement, right? Now, the problem with that, and I'm going to give you the axioms only, the problem with that is that, well, finding if studying entanglement is tough, you can imagine that finding a function, so I want entanglement measures, right? What do I want from entanglement measures? So the same way that when we're talking about measures of ignorance, we set a set of axioms, right, that I have to satisfy. I say, what is reasonable for a measure of ignorance? We can ask, what is reasonable for a function? Remember, this is a function that maps, if you want, bipartite density matrices to the reals. Okay? And it gives me a number. How entangled is that state? 7. And these are the 1, 2. So the first one is more entangled than the second. That's what I want. I want a function that tells me how entangled a state is. A quantifier of how entangled a state is. That's what we call entanglement measures. Make sense? So let's set a series of axioms here of what we desire from an entanglement measure. There we go. So, can you suggest things, you clever people? What would you want for an entanglement measure? What's that? That's actually not an entanglement measure, as we will see. It's not, sadly. For pure state it is, but not for mixed states. We'll discuss that. Mutual information is actually an account of all correlations, quantum or classical. So pure states don't have classical correlations, therefore. We will discuss it. This point of it. But what do we want? I don't want examples of entanglement measures. I want things that you want from an entanglement measure. For example, I'll give you one. must be maximal for maximally entangled states. And we have a really good definition for maximally entangled state, right? That's the one that it's pure, but when I erase one of the subsystems, I get the maximally mixed for the other, like the Bell state for two dimensions. Make sense? Those are maximally entangled states, states that you have full knowledge and of the bipartite system, but when you trace out one of them, you have full ignorance. Because remember, our definition of entanglement is about the ignorance that you gain, or the information that you lose, but the ignorance that you acquire because you erase one of the subsystems about the other. So we have a very clear definition of what a maximally entangled state is, right? A state that is pure, so I know everything about it, but when I erase one of the subsystems, it's maximally mixed. It's a multiple of the identity in the Hilbert space of the other. And the multiple is 1 over D. Make sense, everybody? So if we want a good entanglement measure, better be maximum only when you ask about a maximally entangled state. Make sense? OK, another one. Who gives me another one? Yeah.
I was going to say 0 only for separable states.
That's right. Must be 0 only for separable states. Otherwise, bad measure of entanglement, right? You can have an entangled state. You ask, entanglement measure of that, 0. Oh, so it's not entangled. No, actually, it is. That would be bad. Agreed? OK. Any more? That's the best one. That's literally the best one. So I'm going to write the last, and I'm going to run more here. So it's not enough that it's maximal for maximally entangled state, and that it's 0 only for separable state. We also need to say, no, because we added the only. OK, this one is included. Typically, you said the only already. Typically, it said must be 0 for separable states. The next one is must be non-zero only for must be non-zero for all entangled states. But you got the only here, so you got it covered. Then let's go with the powerful one. Must not increase under LOCC. Why? Well, because we know that local operations can never add entanglement. They can destroy, perhaps, entanglement, but they can never, because you cannot map a state that is separable to non-separable just by local operating in one of them. And local operation classical communication can only create classical correlations, cannot create entanglement, because again, local operations mathematically can't. So a measure of entanglement better be non-increasing under LOCC. Can it decrease? Yeah, for sure. I can do a really bad local operation that decoheres one of the systems or that transfers the entanglement to another system, which, by the way, is the same, as we will discuss. We will talk a little bit about the church of the larger Hilbert space. And that church, if we're in quantum information, is our religion. If you are in foundations, it's probably our religion. If you are into QFT, it's interesting to think about it being our religion or not. I am a believer, by the way, just so you know. So,
which one or both?
What's that?
Which one or both?
The church of the larger Hilbert space, yeah. Oh. Yeah. And we will discuss it in two contexts. We're going to discuss Steinspring theorem, but also we're going to discuss the same theorem for measurement as well, and the Heisenberg cut, when we talk about measurements. Because it's very important in quantum information, these things. Anyway, do they make sense, these three conditions? Yeah? So, because time is over, I'm just going to tell you, of all the entanglement measures that I'm going to tell you, the immense majority of them are not going to satisfy this. And we still call them entanglement measures. There are some, there's at least one that I'm going to tell you that satisfies the three. That one, unfortunately, is not computable easily in most cases. The only way to define a proper that we know, because again, we don't know P versus NP, so at least that we know of, and we have a really, really good intuition that there's no way we're going to find any other. The only measure of entanglement that satisfies everything has to be defined only through a convex optimization, and not an easy convex optimization problem over a huge, huge, huge dimension of parameters. So the problem is that you have to make compromises. If you're a purist, no, I want a true entanglement measure, then be prepared not to be able to compute it. OK? Be prepared for that. Just be prepared. Sometimes you may be really lucky, and you can. but sometimes meaning a zero measure set, okay, that you can build. But if you're not that picky, maybe you can relax some of those. Maybe you can satisfy the three for subsets of states, and as long as you're in those subset of states, you're fine. See what I mean? But not for all states. So we will discuss the different candidates for entanglement measures, and we will do a table about the good and the bad things they have, and then each of you pick your favorite. How about that? I have my favorite. I have one that I like more than others, but I don't want to influence you, so we will discuss. Now, by the way, you can think, some question that I get here. What about the entanglement entropy? Yeah, sure, the entanglement entropy does not satisfy. Okay, it's true, this is satisfied for the entanglement entropy. Is this satisfied? This is true as well, entanglement entropy? Is this satisfied? No, because for mixed states, the partial states has a non-zero entanglement entropy, even if it's separable. Get the product, the tensor product of the two maximally mixed states. That has a maximal, no, actually, it doesn't satisfy the first one either, right? Because that gives you a maximum for a state that is not the maximally entangled state. So the entanglement entropy fails two of them. How is that? It also fails the third one if you allow this to be at a coherent channel. So the entanglement entropy, which is the very loved one that typically is invoked, but the entanglement entropy doesn't satisfy none of those. Not the first, and the second, or the third. Just couple something to the subsystem, right? And let it decohere in a way. But increase. Yeah, it would increase the entanglement entropy like that. And the dose operations, right? Yeah, because you're just saying is the entanglement entropy as the von Neumann entropy of the partial system, and I can increase that. Make sense?
Where's the condition that like this entanglement measure should be able to distinguish between classical correlations and entanglement?
There's no such condition.
We can have some.
We will discuss. We will discuss that, yeah. The thing is that classical correlations are radically different from quantum correlations. We'll discuss it. Yeah, go ahead.
Second condition.
Is satisfied?
Yeah.
Must be zero only for separable states. Yes, you're right. The second condition is satisfied. It must be zero. When can it be zero? Yeah, only for separable states. You're fine. Yeah. Second condition is satisfied. By the way, on pure states, it satisfies the three. So the entanglement entropy is a good entanglement measure for pure states, but only for pure states. Make sense? Make sense? Doesn't?
Not yet, but I will.
Oh, okay. You have questions? Go ahead.
That's okay.
Go ahead.
Because with entanglement entropy, you have to partition the state.
Yeah. You always, for all entanglement measures, you have to partition the state, right? Kind of.
The reason it's so difficult to compute in general for the state would be because you want all possible partitions of the state to know all of the entanglement in the state.
No. Hold on. An entanglement measure or an entangled state is based on one partition. So you make one partition first, and you ask how much entanglement there is. So this is not about many partitions. This is one partition, rho AB. I start from a bipartite state. The partition is already made. And then I ask how much entanglement is there in that state. The partition is already made. I'm not telling you how much entanglement there is in some states for all partitions that you can make of it. No, I'm not saying that. I already gave you the partition. And I asked you to tell me how much entanglement there is. And these three assumptions for the entanglement measure are reasonable, aren't they? But I'm telling you, for example, the entanglement entropy only satisfies the three of them for pure states. But for pure states, it's pretty easy to find if they're entangled or not. So entanglement entropy or many other measures of entanglement work well. Entanglement entropy, in fact, is not the best because it's difficult to compute. But it is the best from the foundational point of view. Why? Because entanglement entropy is exactly, you see, remember how we defined entanglement as the ignorance you acquire when you erase the first subsystem. If your state is pure and you know that you had no ignorance to begin with, then the entanglement entropy captures the essence of entanglement because it's the Shannon entropy of the partial distribution of state two. So in that sense, it's very powerful, informationally speaking. It's really foundational. The entanglement entropy is the canon measure of entanglement if all that we had were pure states. Because it's literally the amount of ignorance as in the Shannon entropy of the partial state after I erase the other system. So something nice to demand, as we will discuss from an entanglement measure, is that for pure states, it reduces to the entanglement entropy. That would be nice. Because a generalization of that thing that tells you the ignorance when you erase one of the subsystems, it really captures the core of entanglement. Sadly, it doesn't work for mixed states. But maybe there are generalizations that do. And maybe they're intractable. Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe this is what you're getting at, but like, couldn't you purify the state and then, like if you had a mixed state, you could purify the state and then study the entanglement entropy?
You could do that, and how do you purify it?
With some canonical purification technique.
Aha, but the problem is that there's no unique way to purify it, and the way to purify it is going to require me to alter the amount of entanglement in it.
Oh.
Keep in mind that you can think of the mixed state as being entangled with something else. That's the Larry Hilbert Space Church commandment number one. We'll see both commandments. But commandment number one, and that means that I have to mess with the entanglement in the state as well to do that. So there's no unique way of doing it. So maybe, and this is not a bad idea, you can do things like those, but then optimize over something like the minimum. I don't want to add. I don't want, you know, you can, and that's what makes it intractable. The moment that you add, all right, but there's no unique way of doing it. The idea is really good, you see? But there's no unique way to do it. I say, okay, but you can be clever about how to do it so that I don't touch the entanglement here. And if you're clever about to do it, then it becomes an optimization problem. And that's the issue. All the entanglement measures that are faithful for mixed states are intractable. Well, not really, are difficult. Let me call it difficult. You can have computers that do it for a particular subset of states, but as long when your dimension of the Hilbert space goes to 6, 7, 8, you cannot anymore. That's the point. Make sense? We will see all that. Oh, we will see some of that. Now, the next tutorial, I think, requires you to have arrived to the measurement problem, so POVMs. So we need to see POVMs. Here's what I'm going to do. On Monday, I will continue with entanglement measures. It can be finished on Monday. But if not, because I love this, this is the best part, when we discuss these things, I think I will, on Wednesday, I'll do a parenthesis. I will not finish that, and I'll see POVMs. So you prepare for the tutorial. How about that? It's not the natural sequence, but it's nice. And this year, I'm feeling the fact that we only have 1 hour. I'm feeling it instead of two. It's a big difference with the previous year. So I'm readapting this. And the tutorials are designed as if we were at the same pace as last year. So because of that, I will see POVMs for sure on Wednesday. Keep in mind that POVMs is a topic that will generate discussion, because I'm not only going to define POVMs and talk about them. I'm going to give you a little snippet of the problems of POVMs within quantum info, but also within quantum info with quantum field theory. OK? And we will see how the measurement problem is non-trivial. A little bit, because it's a quantum info course. So we will see that. OK? We're going to discuss mutual information. So don't worry. Mutual information is such a cool quantity, because it turns out that classically, there are two ways of defining mutual information that are equivalent, completely equivalent. One is operational, as in like based on, you know, mutual information tells you between two distributions, two random distribution tells you how much information I gain about distribution, say x and y, two distribution. And there's a joint probability distribution, pxy. But imagine that I measure x only. Mutual information tells you how many bits of ignorance do I remove about x if I learn a bit about y. That's the interpretation of mutual information. Is how much do I reduce the ignorance about one variable when I know something about the other? And there are two ways of defining this classically, using Bayes' theorem. It's very easy, it's defined classically. And it so happens that the quantum version of it, when you replace the Shannon entropies by von Neumann entropies, the two definitions are not equivalent. So the difference between the two is something. Well, we'll see it, but there are two. One is based on, you know, mathematical considerations of this, of analysis of information. The other one is based on, right, I measure this. So now I have the condition probability of getting A condition to having obtained value B in the measurement. And I can write in terms of conditional probabilities. And I have Bayes' theorem to relate the two. And classically, they're the same always, and you can prove it. Quantumly, they're not. Because what does it mean for a quantum system to make a measurement on A? See what I mean? So these things are tricky. And we will discuss mutual information. The difference between the two definitions is actually what we call quantum discord. Because it's a disagreement when you do stuff in quantum mechanics of things that classically are the same. And you can actually have quantum discord without having entanglement, which makes it even more interesting. So where's that coming from? Anyway, sorry, that was a spoiler. I hope that you enjoy this. Are the topics okay? Are you enjoying them?
Yeah.
All right, good, yeah. Good.